So this evening we're having a talk on spiritual death, and you know, it's an interesting topic to talk about without sounding really bleak. So I'm going to bring in a bit of poetry, I thought. So I'll start with a poem. Busy with many jobs, I forgot one also has to die. Irresponsible, I kept neglecting that duty. I performed it perfunctory, as from tomorrow, things will be different. I'll start dying meticulously, wisely, optimistically, without wasting time. There you go, that's it. So we've talked a lot about integration and positive emotion. We've talked about becoming ethically responsible and creative with our mental states. We've talked about spiritual receptivity and opening out to something more. But all those things aren't enough. They're not quite enough for liberation. As Panti said, the happy, healthy individual which you now are or were must die. Of course, we don't mean literally, just to make that point. Of course, it's not you that dies, it's the sort of self-object dichotomy or harsh distinction that dies, or at least it's chipped away. It's the self-orientated clinging that has to die. The delusion, or what Vasantra calls the ego project. So in his talk, Subhuti goes quite a lot into the mechanics of this. And he talks about how in every experience we have a subjective and an objective pole. And what happens is that we tend to make those subjective and objective poles to experience real and fixed and separate. So in every experience, there's a sense of I'm here having this experience. And you are out there as part of my experience. But everything is in relation to myself. And I have a version to the other, the objective pole of experience, or I have a sense of grasping or clinging onto that experience, wanting to appropriate it into me. But all the time what's going on is this kind of this separation. Bhante said it's a bit like you've got an elastic band with a twist in it. And we've made the subjective pole and the objective pole of experience sort of separate. But actually, all we have to do then is just untwist that knot. So it's not like you'll stop having a subjective pole to experience and an objective pole to experience. It's that you won't identify solely with the subjective in opposition to the objective pole. So yes, we'll always have those poles of experience, but we can release them. We can allow them to become more fluid and open and free. You know, so it's not that the Buddha would go around thinking that everything was subject to his will and everything was all one. There's a sort of, there's a Michiditti, a wrong view that goes around thinking that all the Buddhism said that everything is one. Actually, the Buddha clearly said that it's not that everything is one. There's still a subjective and an objective pole to experience. I still have a sense of myself experiencing things. It's just that that relationship to my experience opens up and frees itself. So that's what we're trying to do in spiritual death. It's not like we're pretending we don't exist, or that we don't have agency anymore, or that we're not experiencing things. Clearly we are experiencing things. Clearly, we're coming from a certain viewpoint in the world. We're trying to open up that relationship to the world so that it's freer and more open. And in a way, we need to be doing this all the time and having this perspective all the time. because working with the karma nirma isn't an end in itself. We're not just trying to be a good person and leave it there. We're not just trying to be better, or in a way the wisest and kindest person that we could be. In a way that would be wonderful. I think Subhuti goes into this as well. It would be great if we were. It's not that those are bad things. It's not bad to be kinder and wiser than we are at present. But in a way, if we stop there, we've missed out on liberation. We've missed out on the sort of fundamental spiritual experience. Because what happens is that even when we become better and kinder and wiser, there's something that always brings us back, the kind of gravitational pull of the self, or self-orientated clinging. So Bhakti described this as being like a rocket kind of shooting out from the earth, and it just hits the orbit of the earth and starts circling the earth without really freeing itself. And sometimes we can have a sense of this in our own practice. We're really developing, we're becoming happier, healthier, more integrated and positive human beings. And yet there's something that pulls us back. There's something that pulls us back, sort of down into the self, down into the samsara. So what does it mean to keep that perspective, to keep the perspective of spiritual death all the time? I think what it means primarily is to keep alive a sense of dukkha. To keep alive a sense all the time that we could go further. So it's a bit paradoxical to say that, because normally we think of dukkha as something we're trying to sort of remove from our experience. But in this sense, I think that the dukkha is, actually I could go further. Actually there's a sense of somehow my practice is limited. And this is what the Buddha talks about really with his sense of the urgent quest. You know, for him, the urgent quest that he undertook before his enlightenment, you know, he got into states of the fourth formless dhyanas, the four formless dhyanas, where he had a completely open experience of neither perception nor non-perception, of total open states of mind, totally free. And yet he realized it was conditioned. It was conditioned by him being in certain conditions of meditation, and that he hadn't eradicated craving. So I think even for the Buddha, there was a sense, well, even though you could get into the formless dhyanas, which apparently if you're in the formless dhyanas, you could just stay there forever. You know, it's a completely blissful experience. But he realized even at that point, I haven't eradicated craving. I've gone far, but I haven't gone far enough. And there's something even with this experience that's limited. So if the Buddha had that sense of dukkha before his enlightenment, you know, even those high states of consciousness, I think it's also, that can be a reflection in us. You know, I could be more. There could be freedom. There could be ultimate freedom, absolute freedom. In one of Shantideva's books, The Shikshu Samachaya, he talks about having the call of shunyata unconditioned and unconfined. So in a sense, what we're trying to do is to keep alive that call of shunyata unconditioned and unconfined, calling us onwards all the time, all the time. Like a little whispering in your ear. It's not enough. No. There's the unconditioned, the unconfined. There's the limitless nature of the blue sky, and you could be following that. So it starts in a way, I think the Noble Quest starts in a way of that feeling that we could be more. Actually, in Pali it's called Sangvega. It's a sort of, it's that sense of urgency, that sense of not wanting to settle at a lower level. And the Buddha really encouraged us to cultivate that sense. Because I think if we have that feeling that we could be more, it makes space for something else to emerge. there are times in one's practice when one feels like you just want to strip everything back. I certainly have this myself, where I just get this sense like, yes, okay, I'm done really well. Here's the pat on the back, and now what? You know, to strip everything back. I remember this very strongly. I had a sort of semi-retreat at Bodh Gaya, where I was going to the Mahabodhi temple every day on my own for all morning, and I thought, you know, that I'd go there and I'd feel this kind of sense of wonderful connection to the Buddha, and I'd sit there kind of composing devotional love poems to the Buddha and ghazals, and I'd be, you know, enraptured by the thought of his golden skin under the Bodhi tree, because that's the kind of thing that I sometimes think. And I got there and basically I just thought, oh no, I've just got to reflect on spiritual death. I've just got to find out who I really am and what's really going on. So I just did a lot of very basic practices, stripping everything right back to the beginning. And it's uncomfortable because, of course, we don't know if we create that space what will emerge, or if anything will emerge. We have to go with it. We have to follow through that process. The Sufis say that to find the pearl of wisdom in the bottom of the ocean, first we have to drown knowledge at the seashore. So it's like knowledge takes us so far. It takes us to the shore of wisdom, the sea of wisdom. But to really find that pearl, we have to drown. He turns from the narrow aisle of liberty, where he still wears a crown, and flings into the night, where our world thins to a razor's edge, and there may be no more sea. Beyond lies the bare path of rejection of images, through the broken water, into completer darkness, and a song I tell to no man, unless he sail with me. So yes, sometimes we have to turn from the narrow aisle of liberty, where our world thins to a razor's edge and there may be no sea. Sometimes we have to go through the broken water into completer darkness. So spiritual death viewed from the perspective of growth is that the ordination process is about working on integration and positive emotion and receptivity. And at the point where you're ready to let that go into something greater and more mysterious is ordination. So the point where you've worked on yourself enough to have that sense of moral agency, to be creative in your states of mind and receptive to something more, and at that point you are ready for ordination. And the ritual around ordination very much supports this sense of going forth from one's old name and one's old being, in a sense, to something more connected to the Buddha, to becoming the daughter of the Buddha. So although we can look at spiritual death from the perspective of growth and different stages along the path, we can also look at it as part of a process that is happening all the time in our Dharma life. Otherwise, we won't be able to participate fully in that process at the time of ordination. You know, if you're not working on spiritual death now, and an aspect of spiritual death in your practice now, you won't really be able to engage with it fully at ordination. So it's something that we need to be reflecting on in our own way at every level. So one of the ways we could look at it is, what holds us back from looking at spiritual death? What holds us back? One of the things is our desire for security and order. So I'm going to read you another poem. It's quite strong, actually. It's about a character called the Spinster. I just want to say I quite like Spinster. The whole idea is quite good. Because basically spinsters only were not... they didn't have to marry because they were able to spin their own wool, so they had their own income. So I think spinsters are cool. I say that. Anyway.
So what did you say? The desire for order and...
Control. This is no way to go on. Get wise. Accept. Be a spinster of this parish. My life's in shards. I will keep fit in leotards. Go vegetarian. Accept. Support good causes. Be frugal. Circumspect. Keep cats. Take tidy fits. She's not so keen on that one. Go to evening classes. Keep a nest egg in the bank. Try yoga. Cut your losses. Accept. Admit you're a bit of a crank. Oh, I may be a bit of a crank, but still I get by frugally. Think positive. I live and let live. Depend on nobody. Accept. Go in for self-improvement. Keep up with trends. I'll cultivate my conversation. I'll cultivate my friends. I'll grow a herbaceous border. By hook, by crook, I'll get my house in order. So in a way, I find that poem quite tragic, actually. It's that line, my life's in shards. My life's in shards. I will keep fit in leotards. There's a sense of, like, a whole crumbling life below you. Mm-hmm. And you're just trying to sort of keep up with this self-improvement program. Mm-hmm. But there's nothing that you can do that will ultimately improve the self. Because you've got to a limit of something where actually you have to turn back and look at the shards of your life. Look at the crumbling life. She last night had a dream that I was living in a tent on top of a mine, which was really interesting, and I knew that at any moment this tent would just sink into the mine. And it was interesting because it's a bit like that's what our lives are like in a sense. You know, we're trying to sort of make this beautiful tent, but ultimately our tent is on top of a mine. And maybe it's a mine of jewels. It doesn't have to be a negative image, actually. Maybe there are jewels in that mine that we haven't, we need to go deeper to find. Anyway, that's how I took it this morning. So yeah, so we attempt to control our lives, and Buddhism becomes something that makes us better, that we add on to ourselves. We build around us a good life, because what would we find if we let go? Well, what would happen if I didn't accept? What would happen then? What would happen if I said, no, this is not the way I want to live my life. No, this is not who I am. What would happen if I faced that shadow, that darkness? In a way, what it comes down to is the problem of literalism. So Panti defines literalism as having an idea of the Arya Pariyasana, that's the noble quest. So having an idea of the noble quest, which we grasp with the intellect, powered by craving. Having an idea of the Arya Pariyasana, which we grasp with the intellect, powered by craving. So we construct an idea of the spiritual life that suits our world, so that we don't really have to change. And it's not even that we necessarily have a tremendously positive idea of the Arya Pariyasana. I mean, I know for myself, I think one thing I really had to work with was that I didn't like myself very much. Because I didn't like myself very much, the spiritual life became about something hard and urgent, or kind of hard-cutting self-improvement program. And I definitely took Padmasambhava, I was really into Padmasambhava, and I definitely took Padmasambhava in this wrong way. Like he was just telling me to grow up, you know, get with it, deal with it. And my shrine at home, I remember, looked like a sort of voodoo kitchen. All sorts of things, and I got a slightly unfortunate tattoo, which remains. You know, and I realised actually what I was doing was the grasping a sense of the spiritual life according to my own sort of mental states, my own intellect powered by craving. And then because I'd grasped the spiritual life in that way, it's like I didn't want to change the fundamental problem, which was the fact that I didn't like myself very much. And when I could address that, the fact that I didn't like myself very much, actually it all opened up. And interestingly, I had a totally different response to Padmasambhava, who I related much more to his compassion and the beautiful red lotus. I'll say more about that in a minute. But yes, or it might be that we need looking after. I think we've all gone through this in our lives, where we feel a need to be looked after and comforted. And the spiritual life becomes about all those kind people looking after us. It becomes about a kind of positive group. But the moment we're challenged, we feel affronted because, you know, this is my sort of safe space where I'm looked after. So, yeah, so we have to go back to the beginning in a way and see what the intellect powered by craving is really doing to the spiritual life, how we're viewing the spiritual life according to our own patterns. So what spiritual death isn't? Well, one of the things is it's not just swapping an old unsatisfactory self for a new satisfactory self. So sometimes people talk about spiritual death in terms of, you know, I used to think that I couldn't draw and now I've gone to an art class, which is great. It's absolutely fantastic and I would really encourage people to do that. But it's not spiritual death. In a way, it's self-improvement, which is great. It's like there's nothing wrong with self-improvement. If we could all improve ourselves, probably the world would be a much happier place. But it isn't quite a spiritual death. That's really working on positive emotion integration and spiritual receptivity. Well, sometimes it's said that any bad experience is spiritual death experience. Well, it might be. But it depends on how we really relate to that bad experience and how we're able to bring in conscious reflection. So, you know, extreme experience of illness or dukkha can be a spiritual death experience, but only if we use it to explore life's true nature. Otherwise, we'll just end up just trying to get a better experience next time, which isn't quite it. And likewise, spiritual death experiences don't have to be terrible. You know, I think because of the word death, it sounds like it's got to be misery and suffering. Well, it doesn't have to be misery and suffering. It could be an opening out. Yeah, it doesn't mean it's a bad experience. So how do we practice spiritual death? Well, I'd like to talk about these in three main areas. There's the cognitive, the emotional, and the volitional. So we'll look at ways to practice spiritual death in the cognitive, emotional, and volitional. So on the cognitive level, this means bringing in reflection. It means reflecting on the Dharma. And of course, to reflect on the Dharma means we have to know the Dharma. It doesn't mean we have to know all the very obscure Mahayana texts, or be able to distinguish the Yogacara from the Majjhimikan philosophy. It just means we have to have enough Dharma at our fingertips that we can reflect on it, that we know what it is. For example, the three lakshanas. I particularly value learning texts by heart, actually. I think that's a really good way to reflect on the Dharma. But we have to reflect on the Dharma when it matters most. So one of the things actually you could talk about in the groups is what Dharma do you tend to have in your mind all the time? What are you turning over in the Dharma? And what do you reflect on when it matters most? Because it's easy to reflect on, for example, impermanence in relation to, I don't know, the British weather or something like that, or the arisal of mushrooms and daffodils. But that won't necessarily challenge our basic self-clinging. You know, because we're not emotionally involved enough, really, with the production of mushrooms or a sunset, even. You know, so we've got to reflect on those things where our self-clinging is at stake. So Bhante distinguished between problems and difficulties. He said that a difficulty is something that you can resolve on its own level using your intellect. Whereas a problem, you have to change the terms of the problem itself. You have to sort of raise your level of consciousness. So when we suffer, when we experience betrayal or disharmony or disappointment or failure, Do we bring in the Dharma then? Or do we just try and use our intellect to solve the problem? Do we make it an opportunity for practice? Because what can tend to happen is when we experience those things, we can tend to make it into a difficulty that we try and solve on its own level, in its own terms. A bit like it's a kind of game of chess where we've just got to manoeuvre the pieces and it'll be okay again. Which is a kind of giant game to avoid dukkha, basically. You know, so we're going to rearrange our life to avoid dukkha and to sort out the difficulty on its own level. So on one hand, that's quite a useful skill to do. There are a lot of difficulties that can be solved on their own level. But there's some problems that can't. And in a way, if you try and solve a real spiritual problem on its own level, it won't work and you're missing out on an opportunity. If we make these things into a problem, we can rise above the consciousness that created the problem. And the consciousness that created the problem in the first place was divided consciousness, that hardening of the subjective and the objective pole of experience, self and other. So, for example, I mean, you know, Subhuti talks about divorce and separation. Well, you know, someone leaves you, you just go and find the next model, and then you've sorted it out on its own level. You wanted a partner, you get a new partner that's slightly better. I love the way I say all this so glibly, because actually, you know, celibacy is not my strong point. Vajrasakhi once asked me how long I'd actually had a period of celibacy in my life. I was embarrassed. Anyway, I could read my own advice. I think I do actually practice this, and I don't just cruise on, is in expectations of the Sangha. So, you know, we all have expectations of the Sangha. I've got expectation of the order behaving a particular way. Oh dear, and it's doomed to failure. So if I treat it as a difficulty, what I'm going to do is basically avoid the people I don't like in the order. And I make little categories of the people who I like and the people who I don't like, people I agree with, people I don't agree with. And then I just avoid any contact with people I don't agree with. I don't read their reporting in Shabda. I sort of take a one birth order weekends, blah, blah, blah. The other way you can do it is you can just leave the Sangha. Of course there's problems in the Sangha. So, you know, one way of approaching it as difficulty is, well, you know, I'm going to move this piece out. I'm going to leave the Sangha. You know, and we can experience this with Bhante. He said or did things that perhaps we may not like. You know, it's definitely things he said of himself. He's been unskillful. So what do we do with that? What do we do with Bhante and the aspects of his character even, perhaps, that we don't even like, let alone unskillful behaviour? Well, we've got different options. We can treat it as difficulty by just getting a giant cosmic pair of scissors and cutting him out of the refuge tree. So there's a sort of hole where Bhante was. Or we can make it a real spiritual problem. And I think this is the real advantage of reflecting more deeply on the controversies. You know, because it's very easy for us in the order as well, who've been through these conversations a number of times, to just want to go, oh no, not again. I've spent far more time talking about Bhante's sex life than I have ever wanted to. But actually, if I just do that, if I just get the, you know, I can feel my sort of legs and arms crossing. If I do that, then I'm missing out on a real spiritual problem. Because from my point of view, I'm very happy to be Bhante's disciple. You know, I really love Bhante, actually. I even made a vow to him, which is a bit embarrassing, but I said to Bhante, like, I just want to make a vow that wherever you go in samsara, I'm going to be your disciple. And he said, does that mean I have to stay in samsara? Yes! Do! Me! Anyway, you know, so on one hand, you know, I love Bhante and I feel really grateful to him. I don't think I'd be a Buddhist if Bhante wasn't my teacher. And yet I can't condone certain actions, you know, certain actions that he did. I feel distinctly uncomfortable with certain things he said. I feel distinctly uncomfortable about. So it's a bit like I can't condone those things and say they're okay, and yet I can't dismiss him either. I have to hold both my own disappointment and my gratitude. Mm-hmm. And I think about holding both those things, not trying to squirm out of either of them, not denying my disappointment and not denying my gratitude. Something really important is revealed about the nature of the spiritual life and my own growth, who I am in the spiritual life and how I relate to my own disappointments in myself, my own failures and my own unskillfulness, and also my own brilliance, in a sense. So yes, I think we can make expectations of the Sangha a real spiritual problem, and not just dismiss it as a difficulty, not just parcel it up in a box and put it away in the cellar. And we can do this with everyday reactions. You know, I really like this image that Subhuti gives as the Loch Ness Monster. So it's like, you know, okay, we think we're pretty special and we don't have a lot of self-clinging. And then, oh, there you are. Oh, I've got rid of you. You're here. I think reactions are really useful because that's where we really see our basic self-clinging. And, you know, we all have them. So it's really good to be able to turn and face them. And in a way, this is the natural consequence of integration, because we're taking responsibility for our reactions. You know, I mean, that's a really important part of integration, is just taking responsibility for your reactions. No matter how justified you think you are, taking responsibility for your reactions. And also, it's a consequence of positive emotion, because you see a reaction for a reaction. You call it for what it is. You know, this is hatred, this is greed, you know, this is aversion, this is craving. And we can see our own self-clinging. We see how we've identified and sort of hardened back into the subjective pole of experience and seen other people as objects in the service of myself and just purely in relation to myself, you know, whether I like them or whether I don't like them, or, you know, basically we're seeing the other in terms of what they do for me or what they don't do for me. It's such a painful way of being in the world, those reactions, because everything is about me. And this is the divided mind, the Atmaklesha's. So I think reactions can be really, really helpful if you can own them as such. And it does help, I think, when one has a reaction, to apologise to the person concerned, but maybe go and talk about it with a spiritual friend. Like, what happened there? Why did that touch me? And it's really interesting working in the team, because what you find out is that other people react to different things. So it's definitely got something to do with you. It's not totally to do with other people. Mm. You know, because, you know, I find that I've reacted something and I've got into a grump about something and I go into community and I say, all right, blah, blah, blah. And then I realise that other person hasn't reacted at all. So, you know, what's it touched in me? What rule has it broken in my own kind of rule book of the universe? So, yeah, in the spiritual life, we will encounter some really deep reactions as well. I think I'm really beginning to see this the longer I practice the Dharma, the more I see that, you know, we can really encounter some very, very deep fear or deep guilt, hatred, all these kind of negative emotions that are sometimes even, we don't even know what they're about. They don't even have a story attached to them. They're sort of this nameless fear. And you can wake up in the middle of the night in total panic and sweat. And you're touching something that feels quite almost primeval. It sort of feels like the ultimate truth about the way things are, the way we are. It feels more real than everyday reality. It's quite shocking. It feels like, oh, I found the sort of root of something. It doesn't even feel like the root of us. It feels like even something more inherent in the nature of the universe. So when we touch those points, I think actually the Buddha talked about it in terms, he said, when we're leaving the abode of Mara, it's a bit like a fish on the seashore struggling for air. We wriggle and turn. And sometimes I feel like that as I'm leaving the abode of Mara. There's something in me that resists and wriggles. So I think when we reach those points, we have to ask ourselves, so what is the experience? You know, how do I know that I'm feeling fear or depression or guilt or anger or whatever it is? What is the actual experience? The actual experience, in a sense, is bodily sensations accompanied by mental stories. So, you know, where do I feel it in the body? And what are the images or stories producing in my mind? Are they true? I mean, I'm quite high thinking type, so I ask myself quite a lot during the day. I get a little story about something and I think, is that true? Mm. Most of the time, actually, no, not really. Is it permanent? What conditioned it? You know, is it unconditioned or did something give rise to this experience? Is it me or mine? Is this myself? Where is the self in this experience? And, you know, even in a way, what we're trying to do is we're trying to dig into the bottom of that experience to find out this structure of self polarized with others, of self clinging, of the me and mine, grasper and grasped. We're trying to see that dichotomy in action. And of course, you know, we are conditioned beings. This is the root of samsara. It's the root of the wheel of life. It's what underlies all greed, hatred and delusion. So we have to also be incredibly patient with ourselves. You know, the Buddha said, you know, there's no beginning to samsara with beings hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving. So we're dealing with something that very, very deep roots, and I think what we have to do primarily is to surround that with love, with a kind of luminous love, the love that is beyond self-clinging, the love that is beyond grasper and grasped, or me and mine, an open and luminous love. Luminous, O monks, is the mind, but it is defiled by adventitious defilements. So sometimes when we get to that root of the fear or the anger or that divided consciousness, the Atma kleshas, we have to surround them with love, the luminous love that is beyond self-clinging. Which brings us into the emotional way of looking at spiritual death. So I said I had a bit of a different a relationship with Padmasambhava, and I took the Padmasambhava practice as a sort of secondary practice after my ordination. So my primary sadhana practice is White Tara, but I did take up the Padmasambhava practice again, sort of later, went back to it later after my ordination. And the night that I took up that practice, I had this dream, and in the dream there was a corridor, an old-fashioned corridor, wooden floor, wooden doors. And one of the doors was open, so I opened the door, and there was Bhante, and he was sitting in front of an enormous red lotus, huge red lotus, made out of light. And he was just sitting there contemplating this lotus made out of light, a deep red. And I knew that he understood the significance of that lotus. And I knew that I didn't understand the significance of that lotus. But the fact that he understood it was enough for me for now. Yeah. So when Bhante talks about metta in Living with Kindness, he says that metta in its fully expansive mode is expanding out beyond the self. The sort of radical edge of metta, with the mind that's gone beyond definition. He said it's like a circle that's expanded to infinity, which is so far that it doesn't even make sense of being a circle anymore. It's just gone wider and wider and wider, and more open. And he says the self is replaced by a creative orientation of becoming. A creative orientation of becoming. And he talks about spiritual death as being openness in the direction of ultimate reality, not holding back on the progress of expansion, not opening up so far, that is to say opening up as regards to positive emotion, but then refusing to open up any further. So this is really the path of love, the path of greater love. Because I think what happens is it's like we experience strong positive emotion, but we keep it walled in. We put limits to that positive emotion. I remember really feeling this actually one solitary retreat. It'd been my birthday, I think, just before. And I put all my birthday cards on the shrine. And what I was trying to really reflect on was just how much love there is and how much I limit it. You know, how much I just put a barrier not only to loving people but also being loved. You know, it's that sort of feeling where you can feel the love flowing between you and your friend. And then it's a bit like, I just look at the floor. You know, there's something in me that can't quite take it. So yes, Hafiz, the sea of love is a sea that has no shore. There you can only give up your soul. So I think in the path of love, we really do have to give something up about our own self-orientation, about that way that we see the world in terms of me and mine. We've got to allow our love to flow beyond the gravitational pull of the self. So one question we could ask ourselves is, who falls off the edge of our metta-bhava? You know, who's kind of on the periphery of the extension of our metta? Or it's a bit like a certain people where a metta is moving up. That was to expand all beings and then it just bungee jumps back. I was reflecting on this actually this morning in the Metta Bhavana because in a way I realised there's a point at which my metta is really papering over the cracks, or really of the divided mind. So what I mean by that is that at the beginning of the Metta Bhavana, we really need to develop a sense of well-wishing towards another really existent human being, because we've got to realise that other human beings exist from their own side. Because quite frankly, most of the time we just go through life sort of forgetting that other people actually have their own existence, you know, because everything's seen in terms of me and what's happening for me. So in the Metta Bhavana, we have a distinct self of I am sending metta to you. You know, I'm here, I'm sending metta to you, I'm trying to realise you exist from your own side with your own thoughts and feelings. But there's a point at which that just doesn't work anymore, because the fundamental distinction between I and others, I mean, I can't figure out another way of explaining it than it's utterly weird. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like you come to a point in your metta bhavana and you just think, what's that about? You know, what's this soul structure of me giving metta to you? Sort of sense of humility perhaps arises. These boundaries are mind-made. And as Dr. Ambedkar said, what the mind creates, the mind can undo. There's a division there. And what we need to do, particularly in the metta bhavana, is realise that actually it's not me giving metta to you. It's mystery sending metta to mystery. We're not fixed, we're not separate. We don't even know ourselves, let alone other people. And have this sense of an unfolding sort of flow of metta between free and open and mysterious people. It just makes you want to laugh, really. I don't know why. Anyway, I found this poem. I think this might be my favourite poem. It's a bit, you have to bear with it, it's not terribly easy to read either. Anyway, it's called A Vision by Denise Levertov. And it starts actually with a quote from Spinoza, who's a philosopher. It says, "The intellectual love of a thing is the understanding of its perfections." Two angels among the throng of angels pause in the upward abyss, facing angel to angel. Blue and green glowed the wing feathers of one angel, from red to gold the sheen of the others. These two, so far as angels may dispute, were poised on the brink of dispute, brink of fall from angelic stature. For these tall ones, angels whose wingspan encompassed entire earthly villages, whose heads, if their feet touched earth, would top pines or redwoods, live by their vision's harmony, which sees at one glance the dark and light of the moon. These two hovered dazed before one another, for one saw sea-feathered, peacock-breaked crests of the other angel's magnificence, different from his own, and the other's eyes flickered with vision of flame petalings, cream-gold grain-feather glitterings, the wings of his fellow. And both in immortal danger of dwindling, of dropping into the remote forms of a lesser being. But as these angels, the only halted ones among the many who passed and repassed, trod air as swimmers tread water, each gazing on the angelic wings of the other, the intelligence proper to great angels flew in their wings, the intelligence called intellectual love, which, understanding the perfections of scarlet, leapt up among blues and greens strong-shafted, and among amber down illuminated the sapphire bloom, so that each angel was iridescent with the strange newly seen hues he watched, and their discovering pause, and the speech their silent interchain of perfection was, never became a shrinking to opposites, and they remained free in the heavenly chasm, remained angels, but dreaming angels, each imbued with the mysteries of the other. So when I first read that poem, I thought, yes, this is the Metta Bhavana. We're dreaming angels, each imbued with the mysteries of the other, never shrinking to opposites, a silent interchange of perfection. And I love that image of having these great wings, you know, the flame-coloured wings with flecks of peacock blues and greens. And the peacock blue and green wings with the flecks of flames and gold. Yes, I think that's true communication as well. When Panti talked about it, he said it's a vital mutual responsiveness, and there can be in that Metta Bhavana and communication that a vital mutual responsiveness, and you come out changed from that communication. So yes, that's the emotional level. The volitional level is similar to that. The emotional, sort of the head, heart and guts, you know, this is the guts level, the action level. So in Living Wisely, Bhante talks about the ego as a functioning, where functioning, not a thing in itself. So it's not that you have to have a self, there's a real existing self or ego that you have to get rid of. It's a way of operating, it's a way of being in the world that has to be transformed. He says, in a way, the ego is really just is just operating on the ball of this sort of tight, basis of this tight ball. You know, sometimes we just feel like we're circling in on ourselves again and again and again. And we feel kind of closed and trapped. And he said, actually, the non-egoistic way of functioning is actually when we just open out and relax. When our being expands without even a centre. Just to encompass all that is around us and the situation as it is. It's infinite creativity from the point of view of Buddhahood. So yes, so from the Buddha is infinite creativity. For us, I think it basically means being less selfish. Sometimes we call this the path of responsibility. It's the path of just doing what's needed in any situation. I think it's particularly good for the individualist like me. You know, I've had to really work with individualism. And just doing what's needed for the good of the situation is very, very good for me. It's that kind of ideal of the of Aniruddha and his friends that we find in the Pali Canon, where they just say of each other, living in the community, why should I not set aside what I want to do and do what they want to do? You know, because you're living without that self-orientated clinging. Everyone's needs become as important as one's own. Bhante talks about enlightenment in this context as work, growth and duty. Interestingly, he doesn't explain what he means by work, growth and duty very much. But we do get a hint of this in the bitendential value of being. He says, to overcome the self and other dichotomy, you have to look deeply into the nature of self and other and what that really means. And he says, well, we've already got a tendency to look at ourselves. So perhaps it might be an opportunity to look more at the nature of what's going on in the objective pole, for others, basically. A bit like you're trying to redress the balance. So instead of just endlessly exploring oneself, you start to explore what other people need and what other people want. So this approach can be a difficulty if we have a tendency to deny our own needs. Now, of course, it doesn't mean excluding ourselves and solely identifying with the objective pole. It means that you're looking at everything in one picture, not that we're left out of that picture. I tend to think myself, and we talked a bit in our group about this, I tend to think myself less and less in terms of needs. I think the language of need is quite unhelpful. Because you get into this situation where everyone has their own needs and then you have to meet everyone else's needs. And it all becomes a bit fixed. I think that's it. It becomes a bit fixed. I tend to think it's much more helpful to think in terms of conditioned arising. You know, in a way, it's a bit like, what are the needs of this situation? Or what's actually happening here? So, for example, if I don't go and have an afternoon nap or go for a walk, I'm going to be really grumpy and I'll take it out on others. Is a bit less fixed than I have a need to go and have an afternoon nap or a walk. Because then no one can argue with you about it, really. That's it. Which basically means someone else has to do the work while you go and have your afternoon nap and take a walk. So if you think about it as conditioned arising, it's a bit like actually these will set up conditions for a more beneficial activity. But then someone else in the team, for example, might go, well, that's great, but actually we need to cook dinner. So perhaps there'd be a way for you to have your walk afterwards or something. Anyway, it's a bigger topic, but I'm just throwing that in to think more in terms of conditioned arising and Paticca Samuppada, the needs. Try and keep, like, maybe it would help if we talked about it in Buddhist language. We're all part of this situation, this crazy situation called life. We're all part of it together. And we need to do what's best now. And I think this is particularly important in the order. You know, the order is a practice in itself. And the order is a practice of working together, seeing oneself as a community, as part of a community, and supporting each other. And there can be a very, very beautiful flow that happens within that, where we're all looking out for each other. And we're all aware of each other and aware of what's going on for each other, and we're all supporting each other. But of course, even this very fine practice of this sort of flow that happens in the order that practice comes up against a barrier, which is, of course, other order members doing their thing. So, you know, it can be quite frustrating as well, because one can experience these situations, for example, on retreat or on an order weekend, where really something bigger happens that's beyond the sum of its parts. You get a real feeling like your individuality is not compromised, but at the same time you're part of something much bigger. What we coined in one convention, we called it the Sanghakaya. Actually, we didn't. Maitravir Nagarjuna came up with that word. Everyone else just got it. Anyway, but yeah, this kind of this sense of being the body of the Sangha, which is greater than the sum of its parts. It was tremendously exciting. You really felt something happen. But, you know, there's also complexity. So there's that wonderful kind of thing that can happen. And then there's also working with people, you know, that often you disagree with their views, for example. And I think it's only possible to really enter into that practice if we have a sense of ourselves as serving a greater vision than ourselves. And to feel that somehow we're all serving that vision. Sometimes we might disagree on things or have different views, but fundamentally we're serving that vision together. And of course that vision for me is that the order was founded by the Bodhicitta working through Bhante. And for all his faults, it was the responsibility that took on him in some way. And that actually something greater is trying to come into being through this order. And if I didn't believe that, if I didn't believe that the order was founded by the Bodhicitta, I wouldn't be in it, because it would be just too frustrating. I wouldn't have that sense of sharing something mysterious and undefined and sort of magical with another order member, despite them being a pain in somewhere. So yes, so it's not just about positive emotion and feeling positive towards one's fellow order members, it's also about having a real sense of that greater vision and letting go of our own self-agenda within that greater vision. You know, as that poem talked about, it wasn't a shrink. It's never a shrinking to opposites. It's actually a real sense of vision. And, you know, I remember being in the consultation process to be a private preceptor. Well, it was hard. You know, it was hard because I got a lot of painful and negative feedback that I had to look at. And I remember Maitreya said, just open up the thatch. So I used to sit at my computer going, open up the thatch. you know, it was hard work. And if I didn't have a sense of the greater vision of the order, I wouldn't have done it. It would have been too. It was just about my own progress. I just don't think I could have handled it. But there was something that was greater than me in there, and that was sort of came to fruition, or comes to fruition in the Kuti. Going into the Kuti and ordaining someone in their private ordination, it's like entering into that blue sky directly and just communicating on the basis of going for refuge. It's an extraordinary experience for me anyway. I think when I actually got ordained, I was like just nervous a bit. But actually ordaining someone much better. Because there really is no sense. I mean, well, I've only done it twice, but in both times there's been no sense of my own ego agenda, you know, nothing. It's a bit like there's something so pure and bright, and there's this person in front of you just looking completely pure and open, and you're just relating on the basis of going for refuge. It's a wonderful, wonderful thing. So it makes a consultation process wonderful. Bhante said, we mustn't forget that to see reality in all things in the universe isn't enough. There also has to be that mutual recognition and enjoyment between creative individuals. There has to be that mutual recognition and enjoyment between creative individuals. And we can really get that in the order. So yes, yeah, so I'll just wrap up. Actually, I will just go. So here's a nut poem from, how do you pronounce that word?
Begwin.
Yeah. They're from the Low Countries. So there you go. There's this community of Christian female mystics. Anyway. I do not complain of suffering for love. It is right that I should always obey her, for I can know her only as she is in herself, whether she commands in storm or in stillness. This is a marvel beyond my understanding, which fills my whole heart and makes me stray in a wild desert. I do think of the order as that way. I do think of it as serving a love that's greater than myself.
Can you read that again?
Yeah. I do not complain of suffering for love. It is right that I should always obey her. For I can know her only as she is in herself, whether she commands in storm or in stillness. This is a marvel beyond my understanding, which fills my whole heart and makes me stray in a wild desert. So spiritual death asks us not just to integrate ourselves and go forward, or to purify and refine our experience, but to look at the structure of experience itself, to unpack that structure. The nature of existence, is it empty or not? Merely feeling this doubt tears samsara asunder. Lovely quote from Atisha. So asking those questions itself tears samsara asunder. So in the silence, we can definitely look at our own spiritual receptivity and what we naturally respond to. We can also watch our mind and be receptive to our minds. Look at our reactions. Look at our problems. You know, real spiritual problems, not just difficulties. What are our real spiritual problems? See if we can expand our metta beyond the reaches of the known. And look for opportunities to serve from a place of greater vision. So I'll end by a poem from Rumi. Padrasaki's fan Rumi. Put this in for her. I don't have very many Buddhist things in here, but never mind. Last night, I dreamt I saw an old man in the street of love. He beckoned me with his hand. Come this way to me. If a dragon blocks the path, love works like an emerald. The glittering of the emerald will repulse the dragon. That's my cryptic teaching.